of looking that gets you to doing is an intense look. And don't we all need that? You see, that's really our problem sometimes, really. You know, we believe things to be so, believe things that are right. But we're not always intense with what we believe. And so we're feckless in that way. We're not able to do what we should because we're not intent. And so the challenge for us is not to reaffirm our faith, but rather take our faith and intently examine it, examine who we are in respect to it. By doing so, then we're prepared to be doers, okay? Those who look intently. Why does James speak a lot about, and it is throughout this whole epistle, what is the main thread? Chapter 1, verse 19, for instance, verse 26, what's a commonality? Yeah, well, that's true, tongue. Right. Speaking, what you say. Now, obviously, some of them will say, hear is important. Speak, you know, listen more than you speak, etc. But either way, in every one of those instances, if you'll notice, I got chapter 1, 19, 26, chapter 2, 3, which is also verse 12, verse 16, verse 18. Then chapter 3, verses 1 through 12 is really the dialogue of that, the speaking. Chapter 4, verse 3, verse 11, verse 13. Chapter 5, verse 9 through 10, and verse 12. That's a whole lot on the ideal of saying. So, and then of course, when you take chapter 3 in verses 1 through 12 into context, James says we better be careful about what we say. That's the crux of it. We've got to be careful about what we say. We must pay attention to what we say. Well, how do we do that? How do we make sure that our saying is well spoken? That's right. That's a way of putting it. Yeah. The gear, the mind, and the gear. So really what it is what we're thinking, right? So we say, well, and it's more than just the casual conversation. Obviously, everything that we say needs to be with grace, right? And we don't need to speak out of turn. We don't need to be speaking that harms another necessarily. That's not what we're told to do. We're not to slander, etc. We understand all of that, but it's even more important if we take in consideration everything. That is, who we are before God and how we present ourselves, not just in casualness, but as a spiritual creature is very important. I make this point occasionally, and I made it maybe a few weeks ago in a sermon, and aren't we all guilty of just talking about things of unimportance? We do it all the time, don't we? We talk about this, we talk about that, we talk about, and there's nothing wrong with the things that we talk about, but is that all we talk about? You see? Now, James, of course, in chapter 3 is going to be talking about being very careful because we need to be hearers, we need to be swift to hear, etc., and slow to speak, etc., and we've already seen that, swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. But really think about it, that's also important. It's also important to understand what we talk about. Because if we have something to say, all right, then if it's what we have to say that God wants or that will increase our faith, strengthen us, help another to do the same thing, help somebody else to learn, then we do well. But we're trivial, aren't we? We have a lot of trivial things to talk about. So I thought it was very important to understand. Now, James's, again, point is obvious that he is talking about things that involve our faith. Verse 19 again. Then you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. All right, so that informs our conduct. Again, verse 26, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Again, we can be talking about things of no importance, things that are useless or wasteful. So I just want you to see that. Any questions or comments about that? is there more, or if there is more, to the religion of God, why does James only give us these two things to practice for purity's sake? He says, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction. We believe there's more to it, right? Why does he only give us these two? Okay, that could be very much. James has a focus, doesn't he? See, he's more than just, okay, as general and covering. No, he's covering some basis. He's covering some foundations for purpose sake. In other words, what he is describing for us is, as David points out, the things that, as James is addressing, that people mess up with a lot, right? In other words, the care for others, the concern. The people who are slow to speak obviously are paying attention, right? As we've talked about a while ago. And it's obviously an issue when you consider the rest of James, when he talks about the rich and the poor. We've already seen that once, right? Rich are to be humbled and be thankful for their humility. And the poor are to be grateful that they have been made rich, is the ideal. And so later on, he will talk about those who give honor or undue consideration for the rich man and say, hey, you said here and you experienced this, and the poor man is disregarded wholeheartedly. Right? Now, you got to understand, socially in the context, this is very common in the day. Outside of Christianity, this is the way it worked. It's not the what God had intended, even with his people. But if James is writing to the Hebrew people, they have been doing just as poorly as the pagans around them. But isn't that true of most societies? We really have, as we call, a caste system. And there's, regardless of what we are seeing here, when we talk about it later on about the sitting, it's more than just saying, okay, make sure that the rich person gets the prominent seat, because we have people that enjoy the back seat as much as they like the front seat. So that's not even the question. The question is, how do you respect or give deference to those who have something as opposed to those who don't, or those who seem to be street people, whatever the case may be? And so it's not that we're to fawn over everybody, to fawn over all the poor, but to understand in context that James is talking about people who are rich, they generally do these sorts of things he will talk about later on, and the poor don't. Again, the issue at hand is that you pay attention to the vulnerable among you. You want a pure religion that's undefiled? Look at those that cannot help themselves. Right? If they can't help themselves, they're the ones that are in danger. They're the ones in trouble, and you need to look for them. And that's really the point that he is making here. And he sets this up, I think, as a pretext to what he's going to be talking about later on, particularly in chapter 4. Any questions about that? Chapter 2. What kind of favoritism is James referring to? Yeah. So, personal favoritism. Now, the favoritism that he is talking about, and that's why I asked the question, isn't the kind where, I favor my kids because I go home and take care of them, or what have you, or my wife. I don't favor Kyoko, but I favor my wife. He's not talking about that. He's not talking about friendships. He's not talking about relationships. So we get confused about that. We certainly can get involved in cliques, and he certainly will be dealing with those sorts of things. But the problem is more than that. Because remember, we've already set the stage to talk about how, what he would do, or what these persons might do against those that are vulnerable. And later on, like I said, we're going to get into more specifics. But here, in context, he will talk about the man who comes in with this gold ring, and he's dressed in these fine clothes, and there comes a poor man that's in dirty clothes, etc. He's not talking about even just being nice to one over the other. He's talking about specifically showing disdain for, in action, for those that are lesser than you are. All right? Disregarding. Now, obviously, he's talking about it in context to assembly. And in those days, well, I don't know how often that would occur, but I know that there was probably a lot more difference between rich and poor then. By nature, there are some places in this world, there's no what we call middle class. Most of us are rich, really, beyond most of the people in the world's imagination. And yet, most of us aren't, well, we're not millionaires, are we? So, but that doesn't change anything, does it? So we don't really feel or see this quite like they will. And so consequently, what he is telling us, or what he's telling them in particular, is that you be very careful about who you give deference to. It's not just like, this guy's going to be nice. You're ingratiating yourself, is what he's saying, to this one person, because you think that somehow this person deserves that, and maybe you'll garner some kind of favor. That's the ideal. It's not about friendship. It's not about people that you have interest with, commonalities. That's not what he's dealing with. He's talking about specifically showing favor, and obviously there's motives there. You expect that that person will favor you or give you some type of benefit or whatever the case may be, because you don't make friends with poor people. That's the ideal. You go to a place where you do have society that is much poorer than in other places, they'll fawn over. I'll go to India, and there will be people that would fawn over me. Why? There's already an assumption there, which is true in part. I have much more than they have. I may have much more than 15 or 20 households. And so, of course, I'm a favored one, aren't I? Not just among Christians, but among Indians in general, as a general rule. And that's exactly the temper of what you see here, that there's a serious distinction. And there's not just a low disregard, there's a total, not just ignoring, but a total disdain and for those that are poor. And that's what he's talking about, showing favoritism, deciding. And we can do that in many ways. We can do that when we're talking about teaching somebody the gospel. This person's not a candidate because, and it has something to do with their economic situation. These persons are not a candidate because, well, we know kind of the lifestyle that they live. And it's not quite like ours, etc., so on and so forth. These people are candidates because, I was in a study a few weeks ago on this particular chapter with some preachers, and the point that was made was very important in that you think about it. And I'm not, none of us are, of course, I'm not blaming any of us here, but as a general rule, you go to a congregation when you have a visitor that comes in among you. Let's say an elderly woman or a man came in, didn't look necessarily in good condition or whatever, or let's say a family, 3 or 4 or 5 kids down the row. Which one are you going to run to first? Who are you going to be really looking at first? Who are you going to be going to first? Now, I'm not saying any one of us are like that. I'm just saying, as a general rule, who are you most excited about? Family. The family with 3 or 4 kids. Why? You see the numbers there. You see the ones that are going to be in the classrooms. The young, the vibrant, the healthy, the strong, right? You see, that's our way we think. We're a young society. We think young. And I don't mean we're a young society in the sense of statistics, but we think that way, don't we? We think like this. We enjoy health and youth and all that comes with that. And that's not any different when it comes to the church. That's true with denominations. It's true with the Lord's people. And we have those tendencies. Without really telling anybody that they're bad or anything in that regard, we do think that way. Who are we excited about seeing? The families that come in? Really, or that occasional old folk?
Everyone, really. I know. Many years ago, if there's a visitor, I'm going to meet that visitor. I don't care what else
right.
is going on. I want to meet that visitor.
And that's a good attitude.
You're either an encouragement or a discouragement.
But that's a good attitude, and I agree with you, Joe, but I'm just saying, as a whole, what do we do? Yeah. Who are we excited about seeing? Oh, we got to have more young people. You talk about churches that are small on that. We're short on that, aren't we? churches that look like maybe if we don't get any more young people, you hear the conversation, then we're going to die or whatever. I agree. Youth can obviously convey the next generation. I get that. But is that our objective? Is that the point, you see? And so that really lends to this argument here about favoritism. See, we don't have to have, because for us, when we look at this text, to be quite frank with you, there's probably not going to be a multimillionaire come into the assembly. But unless that person's a famous celebrity and you know them, you may not even know that. And they're generally not going to dress much different than you, and you're not going to distinguish. Because again, most of us are about the same socioeconomic class, right? But obviously you recognize the street person that comes in. There's a very distinct difference in lots of ways, right? But the point that the guy was making, which makes good sense, is what do we recognize? That family? Not that old lady, as we might think, or that old man or whatever. That older person. But we see that. So this is how it could apply to us, that we could get trapped and caught into the same swirling circle of which we give due respect, not because we disdain that older person, that's not the point, but who do we want, who do we favor? You know, I say here you got a choice. This old couple can come, older couple can come and worship here, or that family in their 30s with three or four kids. Which one do you want? Pick. You get one or the other, you know? And I'm not saying that we would, of course, we need to be acting that way as picking, but we get the picture of the favoritism that he's discussing here. And that's what I'm saying. The kind of favoritism he's talking about is a deference based on carnal reasoning. In this case, he's a wealthy man. He can do something for me. Like if I go to India, here's a rich white man. He can do something for me, right? That's how it works. That old poor Indian over here can't do nothing for me, so why am I going to go over and give him any time of the day or a woman or whatever, right? Well, the same goes for us, except we don't have that same kind of dynamic. What do we have? Well, we'll get something out of these young folks, but we won't get anything out of these older folks. I'm picking the old ones over here and the young ones over here, so that's kind of how we're... But you get the picture. That's how we would apply what he's talking about here in one way. Now, of course, we could do it in the same way he's doing it because people have fawned over celebrity status, wealth, etc. You know, sometimes rich people do go to church. And so therefore, and I mean rich, you know, people that are millionaires, in which case you can. You can do the exact same thing that they're doing here. James tells us clearly, pay attention, not or judge people based upon the material world. No, do not judge them based on the circumstances of this day. Everybody needs to be judged righteously based upon the spiritual. It's based upon the spiritual circumstances. Now, I don't mean I scrutinize you, are you a Christian or not, but I do act with the consideration that you are a precious soul in God's sight. Which really what the intent would be is not one or the other. James is not saying disregard that guy and go to the poor guy. But there is a point to be made. Maybe the poor person is certainly going to be more humble in God's sight. What are you looking for? You're still looking for the spiritually minded one, the humbled one, the one with humility, the one who is interested in the things of God. And again, it doesn't have anything to do necessarily today in our society, in our place, with wealth. But it may have everything to do with, again, there obviously has everything to do with their humility of heart. Okay?
Verse 4 answers this whole thought.
Mm-hmm. Made distinctions, have you not? And you judge with evil motives, as Brother Miller said. Okay, that's it. And when he says evil motives, he don't think, oh, you guys got some, we got some diabolical plan. He just simply says, if you think that you can measure somebody's worth based upon this life, that's what evil men do. Therefore, you're acting with evil motives. I don't consider you worthy because, number one, you have something. I don't consider you worthy because you have something I want. Say, like I said, if I want young people. I can't consider you worthy, right, based upon your temporal circumstance. But what I do need to consider you worthy for is for your love for God and the potential, if I don't know, assuming you were a stranger. All right. But why are the poor chosen to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom? Kind of already alluded to that, but it's a simple truth. What's the thing that we theme we see in the Gospels often about? Jesus ends up with whom? Poor people. And the people that are in the worst muck of sin and they realize it, right? That's the people he ends up being with. Why? Correct. Well, you're receptive. Because what you learn in the Gospels or in this case is that the only people God desires is the receptive, the people who are interested. I mean, he loves all men, don't get me wrong. But if I'm a wholly arrogant, prideful man that don't think I need anything, what's he going to... There's nothing to penetrate. I mean, I've already... It's kind of like I've done my say and I've said what I will do and act the way I will. God can't penetrate that. He can't just beg you. And notice that when you think of Jesus and his work, not that he would never talk to the rich folks or the people of importance, but look, take your time to look through the Gospels and see how often he's with those guys. He's invited occasionally, like with a Pharisee. Nicodemus seeks him at night, right? But he's not with these kinds of people all the time, is he? And he don't spend any time in Jerusalem. He's in Galilee, which is disdained by the leading class in Jerusalem, those priests and the scribes and the Pharisees, etc. And who comes to him? Who clings to him? Now, don't mistake, again, the fact that just because you're poor, don't get the idea, just because you're poor, that somehow that makes you now acceptable before God. Because otherwise, you got to go to John 6 and you find out, well, these poor masses, all they want him to do is feed them all the time. And they walked away sorrowful because that wasn't what he was all about. So it's possible to be in that group that would be disdained by the leadership and still want from Jesus what he isn't going to offer. But what is always true as a general rule is poorer people with less distractions, less attachments to this life, have a greater interest. That's why you hear about great successes in many foreign countries of second and third class. Because the second and third world has fewer distractions and more people have nothing more than just what they have for bare necessity at best. And they struggle day to day. And so they hear the things that are heavenly. They have an interest in those sorts of things. Therefore, they're tending to be converted more often, even among denominational. Now, that doesn't mean we have to give up everything, but we could be like the rich young ruler, though we may not have millions. Our worldly goods can be a distraction, and we need to be very careful. Why does James call the law the royal law? If he's quoting from the Old Testament, and I think that's what we understand, he's quoting from the Old Testament, but he still calls it a royal law. If, however, you are fulfilling the royal law according to the Scriptures, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. Who else quoted that in the New Testament? The loving your neighbor as yourself. Yeah, Jesus. Sermon on the Mount is an example. He echoes the same thing. But he does call it royal law, which what I'm getting at is that there's a bridge here. James is talking to a Hebrew people who are very knowledgeable in the Hebrew law. And yet, he's making a connection between the old and the new. In other words, the completion of the thought that God always intended to look forward to the royal law. But the royal law had been at least in part spoken in principle back then. So then he's bringing their attention having them to look back and forward all at the same time. He says, if, however, you are fulfilling first the royal law. What royal law? It's the law of the king. Who's the king? Jesus, the Christ. So that's the royal law. And that's what we serve. We are, as Peter tells us, we're a priest of that royal king, right? That we are a holy priesthood. We serve in a as subjects in a kingdom, and he's our king. So, looking forward, then he quotes from the old, looking back. Though it has deep and abiding meaning, even for eternity, he says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, and if you do so, you are doing well. Remember what you were given then, and see how that is a fulfillment of the royal law. In other words, your focus needs to be on the royal law, which means that you don't give a deference to anyone, but rather you pay attention to all. You give deference to all is the ideal. Not really a deference, I suppose, but did you give necessary, as necessary, attention to those, to all, your neighbor, okay? And of course, if you show partiality, he says you commit sin. How do we apply verses 12 through 13? So speak and so act as those who are to be judged by the law of liberty, for judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy, and mercy triumphs over judgment. All right, so is James the only one that speaks of the law of liberty? Where else do we read about the law of liberty? What other author of the Bible tells us of the law of liberty? Paul, Galatians chapter 5, verse 1. Remember what he says in Galatians 5, 1. Turn over there. See, this is important because what we have is more than just a change. It is certainly a change of law in the sense that we don't serve or work, live under the old law for various reasons. But and even the most important one is because Christ died and instituted, as it were, in his death, a new will and testament. All of that's true. And those are the technical aspects. No problem with that. But it's more precious than that, because what we discover is the one that we had before, or we, though the one that the Jews had before, wasn't the law of liberty. Never was described as such. But notice what James says. Paul says, it was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again as a yoke of slavery. Freedom. Because we have a law that brings us free. Makes us free. Again, what were we under bondage? Correct. And that would be true of the Jews or the Gentiles. Didn't matter. Okay? And what we need to appreciate is that forevermore, well, at least until the end of time, all men have an opportunity to be broken or freed from that. And that's why it's a law of liberty. See, we think of it from one perspective. We think of liberty as freedom to do things. So we think, well, we're in the law of liberty. We can do that. And agreed that there are freedoms from and to some things, but the from part is very important. The from is very, very important. And that's why Paul talks about it, and that's why James talks about it. These are the two contexts or the two texts that deal with this law of liberty. Here, as I said before, he calls it he just calls it the law of liberty. Another perfect law of liberty. But the ideal is still the same. And that is, number one, speak and act. Remember what we said earlier? He says a lot about saying things, doesn't he? But now we hear the word and deed. Colossians 3:17, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus in word and in deed. Same thing's true in James chapter 2, and we've already seen it in chapter 1. We are to be doers, but we are also to be hearers. Hearers of the words won't work only. Hearers and doers were the only ones that will work. Well, again, we speak and so act as those who are judged by the perfect or the law of liberty. In other words, understand that you will be judged. I will be judged, but I will judge by the law of liberty. Yes, it's a freedom, but it's a freedom from, in this context, I believe, is the implication. You are now free from sin. Act accordingly. What do people do when they receive something they do not expect or ever receive, or they don't have, that is something they've longed for and they're excited about? What do they generally, what do we generally do? We step over ourselves, just so excited and so happy that we have received something so great. We just can't imagine, and we're in that elated state. That's the ideal. And so when we recognize what we have received, then it makes us appreciate what others can have as well. See, all of a sudden what he says is, if you act according, because you speak and act as one who is judged by the law of liberty, you are turned back and reminded of which God has saved you from, total condemnation. In which case, does any carnal measurement or carnal judging work? Me measuring you about how much you have, deciding who you're worth based upon your net worth, does it matter anymore? Can it matter? Right. Yeah. Yeah. The point I'm saying is if you understand you're being judged by that, then you remind from what you came from, so then you don't want to judge that away anymore. It doesn't matter to you. Yeah, there's a guy that's rich. Yeah, that's kind of neat. He's done this or that and the other. But I don't matter anymore, because whether or not that man has money or not is not relevant to the eternal perspective. So now what it is, it's the equivalent of looking at Colossians 3 verse 1, that we set our mind on those things that are above. So he says, act accordingly. Remind yourself what you've been freed of. You have the law of liberty. It isn't just the ideal of getting to do things. It's the ideal of not being condemned now. You're free. If you've ever been enslaved, you're free, is the point. And you have been if you've had sin. For judgment will be merciless to one has shown no mercy, and mercy triumphs over judgment. So it's two-plexed. One, the first part, look at the perspective on how you decide how you interact with other peoples. How do you see them? Oh, I don't just see the rich fellow over there. I don't see the wealthy Joe that's got it all. What I see, because I go back and I look at, oh, this is what God has done for me. Wow, I'm free from all of that baggage. So now I'm going to judge Joe on a spiritual plane, not on temporal. So now I look at him differently. I don't mean that I don't know that he's rich, but it doesn't matter. It's not relevant to the picture. And we've got to practice that. It's not going to happen so easily and naturally, because if we're carnal thinkers, we're going to think that away, aren't we? Now, the second part. Second part is, if you think otherwise, remember this. When you judge unrighteously, no mercy will be shown to you. Not from another man, of course, but from God's perspective. God says, mercy will be given to those who judge in a merciful way. For mercy triumphs over judgment. And obviously in context, he is looking at the very distinct difference between those persons in that society. You've got a rich man and you've got a poor man. And there is a lot of difference. It ain't even the same as us and a millionaire. It don't even register. See, me and a millionaire, I don't want for anything. Millionaire doesn't either, and he gets a little extra than what I get, right? Or maybe a lot extra. But I'm not starving, and I'm comfortable. But what James is talking about, this guy over here is struggling for his next meal, and maybe even in desperate situation as far as clothing and a host of other things, and the fellow over here, he's got everything he needs. So there's a big difference between the two persons, aren't there? So then mercy is very important. That's why sometimes these kinds of texts are difficult for us to apply, because in reality, it's hard. We don't have many examples like that. It's only occasionally we run across that. So how do we judge it? We got to judge it when we look at it from for other reasons, not just money, not just creature comforts, etc. When we talk about differences that we discuss. But nonetheless, the principle still applies. One, act like you've been freed from your sin. So every time you look at the other fellow, you're looking from that window. It's heaven's view, not yours, not temporal, not on the surface. And then be reminded, if you think otherwise, because judgment without mercy will be judged accordingly. For mercy will always triumph over judgment. All right? Any questions or comments about that? Yes, Brother Prince. Ah, good point. I don't have, I have a Trenches, but I haven't looked at that to do a word study. But now you got me thinking. Right. Right. No, but what I have noticed, and I haven't looked at that from Trench's word study, but they are connective. They have to be connected together because of God's grace. As you pointed out, remember this, God's grace appeared to all men, but that doesn't mean all men receive grace. What we have seen from God is one thing. What we're willing to accept from Him is another. In which case, if you think about it in context of mercy, then by token, His grace is a merciful act, right? So it's hard to distinguish, but I'll look up Trench's word study on that particular. Maybe I'll have something to add. All right. Anyone else? Yes, Brother Prince. Synagogue. Yeah. We haven't talked about it. He uses the word synagogue as opposed to ecclesia, church, but it's synagogue for assembly.